You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The way we look at the world is often shaped by the colors we see. Color can convey an emotion, like red for anger or for love. It can tell us a temperature, like a cold blue. It can symbolize an idea, like green for nature. Sometimes our eyes can deceive us, and two people might look at the same object and see two different colors. There was that famous dress that went viral back in 2015 that people saw as either blue and black or white and gold. There's the less famous pair of shoes that I saw as gray, but everybody else in the whole world saw as brown. Many paintings or other artworks can create optical illusions with color that make you perceive the same color differently just based on what else is around it. Our next guest has spent years researching the way our eyes and our brains perceive colors to understand how it works and how it shapes the way we see reality. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you ever disagree with friends or family members about what color something is? Do you have questions about how we see colors, where we might get things wrong, how it all works in our minds? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Bevel Conway is a neuroscientist, artist, and senior investigator in the Perception, Cognition, and Action section of the National Eye Institute within the National Institutes of Health. Bevel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Rob.
You've devoted a lot of your work to studying color. What led you down that path?
I started as a kid, you know, when my mother's sister gave me my first set of real watercolors, you know, the kinds in tubes. When I was probably seven, and I just remember squeezing out these saturated pigments and watching the puddles just bleed into each other. And it was like, you know, better than movies. I got to create it. It was like I was the director of my own little movie. And I just was like, this is so cool.
Now, what actually is color? When young Bevel was looking at that paint color, what was happening?
Yeah, the question of what is color is perhaps the oldest question in psychology. It goes way back to the ancient Greeks. And, you know, what's really interesting is that there was this shift when we developed technology like cameras that made us think that we could take color out of the world. You could make a black and white picture. And, you know, before we had that technology, vision was color. That's all there was. It was, you open your eyes, you look around, the stuff you see around you is just color. It's like there. And so, you know, there's been this kind of interesting experiment that technology has done to us to make us think that color is somehow something we can pull out of the world, but it's really not. You know, your question is, what is color? It's lots of different things. And the way I like to think about it is it's really the interaction, the two sides of a coin between the stuff in the world and your mind. And it's kind of where those two things meet, make this thing we call color.
And different cultures, and I remember this back in school, different cultures might have more or fewer words for color, different ways of divvying up the spectrum. What do we see? How much variety is there out there in what cultures call colors?
There is a terrific variety in what different cultures call colors, the way they carve up what we think of as a color space. Some languages, they may only have two or three terms that everybody in the community knows that they can use to communicate colors. And other cultures, like, you know, English is one of them, we have probably 15, 20 terms that everybody in the society and the culture knows. One of the old questions is whether or not that means that the people, the cultures that only have two or three color terms, do they not see those colors? And that is absolutely wrong. They definitely see those colors. They see all the colors that we see with our fancy color naming system. They just, you know, for one reason or another, they haven't sort of settled on needing to communicate what they see to each other.
What is going on in our brains when we get that visual input? What's going on to say, yeah, that's red, but that's blue, Rob?
Oh, my God. That is the million-dollar question. So, you know, when you walk around, people have probably heard of rods and cones, the two types of photoreceptor cells in your eye. You can think of these as, you know, little eggs in an egg carton, a big cup egg carton, all facing the incoming light, you know, ready to catch it like a catcher in a baseball game. They're all sitting there waiting for their photon to arrive. And when, you know, in normal daylight, We only use the cones. So the rods are completely quiet or almost completely quiet. And so that means that the cone types that you have, the three cones you have in your eye, they are supporting all, everything you think of as vision during daylight. So they give you black and white vision and color vision and motion and faces and where you are in the world and everything you think of as vision. And those three cone types happen to be tuned to different parts of the rainbow. So you've got one that's tuned more towards shorter wavelengths, and then you've got two that are squished very close in, you know, their peak sensitivity is right in what we call yellow in the rainbow. And somehow your visual system sort of listens to these three cone types in the eye and says, okay, you know, I'm going to compare this one and this one and this one and this one, and I'm going to, you know, interpret those signals to be red or to interpret those signals to be blue. But there's a heck of a lot more that's going on than just a kind of straightforward code listening to those three cone types in the retina. There's all the stuff about what you expect to see, what you've seen before, whether or not, you know, that patch of light is next to another patch of light. You know, when you probably when you were an elementary school kid, and if you aren't still like me painting, you know, you remember putting a colored mark on the page. And then, you know, someone comes along and says, OK, now you filled in your apple with that color. Now paint the background. And you go and paint the background. And all of a sudden, the color you thought was perfectly good in the apple is now a different color. And you're like, ah, why did that do that? And that's because color isn't just related to the light coming to your eye from one little patch in the scene, in the painting. What you ascribe to that patch in the painting is actually a kind of unconscious summing together of everything that you are seeing right now and everything you've seen before.
We're talking about the science of color with neuroscientist Bevel Conway. You can join in with your questions, your experiences with perceiving, maybe misperceiving color at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Shelly is with us in Blanchardville. Shelly, hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I was just going to comment that every time we put paint on a wall, my husband and I definitely argue about what color it is and whether or not we need to run back to Menards to get a different version.
Yeah, who's right when you argue about this, Shelley?
Never him.
Thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate that. So what is the deal there? And I think a lot of people have had that experience where we disagree over what color something is. What's going on, Bevel?
Yeah. And, you know, there are a couple of different factors going on there. So one of them is, you know, when you go and you buy that, you get that paint sample from the wall and you put it on the wall, you know, are you painting the whole wall with that color before you decide what color it is? A lot of people, you know, get a little sample, they put it on the wall and they think, yeah, that looks good. And then they paint the whole wall and all of a sudden it doesn't look as yellow as you thought it was going to. So there can be some of this sort of, how good are you at picturing in your mind's eye what colors things will turn out? But, you know, one of the most interesting features of color is the gender asymmetry. So, you know, speaking in general terms, this certainly isn't true of all men and all women, but women tend to have more color terms than men, and they tend to kind of care more about it. They talk more about color terms or use color terms more often in language. It's almost like they're a little bit more attentive. And I'm in a same-sex family. I have a male spouse, you know, so we're sort of stuck just with the two of us trying to figure out what to do with our children and how to relate to them and make sure they get enough color terms. But one of the things that one of the experiments we ran a number of years ago was we asked people what colors things looked like when they sat inside a room that was illuminated with low pressure sodium light. I don't know if you're familiar with this light. It's that kind of eerie yellow light that they used to have in parking garages.
Parking ramps, yeah.
Yeah. And what's weird about that light is that your retina can't encode any color information. You're actually completely colorblind. And most people sort of don't notice right away. They're like, something's weird. I don't know exactly what's going on. And when we tested men and women in this environment, the women were much more likely to be like, there's something fishy. No, I can't see color properly. And your face, wow, that looks really green and weird. And the men were like, you know, they'd mark down on a little display what they were seeing. And exactly what they were seeing looked just like what the women were seeing, They just were not particularly inclined to tell us about it.
We are talking to National Eye Institute neuroscientist Bevel Conway about how we see colors, the way our color perception shapes our reality. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think a lot about the role of colors in your day-to-day life, maybe your line of work? If you're colorblind, I'd love to hear from you about how that affects your life. Join in with your experiences or questions about color at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Bevel Conway, neuroscientist, artist, and senior investigator at the National Institutes of Health. He's with us today to share his research into how we see color and the ways our color perception can affect our everyday lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Got an email from Emmanuel in Strawberry Point, Iowa. Emmanuel writes, "When I go from a bright room into a dimly lit room, I see what's there fine, but with a slightly different overlay of small red dots with yellow circles around them and green circles around those. Are these my cones continuing to fire at full blast?" He says, "I don't have diabetes or any visual abnormality. Is that a thing, Bevan?"
Well, that is very interesting. It's definitely not your single cones. They would fire with two, you know, that if you activate a single cone at a time, the dot of light that you would see is so small that most people wouldn't notice it. There is a technique now that's being used to try and do that. And I actually had my retina stimulated with single photons of light not too long ago, just to see what it's like. My guess is that it's probably related to the blood vessels that carry red blood cells in the blood vessels in front of the eye. And there's they're refracting a little bit of light, and that may be what you're seeing. But it's an interesting observation.
Thanks for that note. Let's go back to our callers now. Sam is with us in Shatek. Sam, hi.
Going back to the lady that said she and her husband can't agree on colors.
We lost Sam. We got a note. He told our producer that the True Value Hardware there won't allow men to buy paint unless he's got a signed certificate from his wife. Okay. Sorry we lost you, Sam. That actually reminds me of a follow-up, Bevel. You mentioned that, you know, at least in American culture, women have more words for color, more interest in it. Do we know, is this something biologically brain-based? Is this a social thing? Women are brought up to be more interested in these colors. Do we have a why behind that?
It's probably a social thing. In fact, it's almost certainly a social thing. One of the big questions in our business is, why do we have color? And some of your listeners might be like mm-hmm. confused. Why is there a color expert at the National Institutes of Health? That seems weird. and the answer is that color is one of the first things that first aid responders will notice when they look at someone. You know, they're called to attend to someone who's in duress, and one of the first things they'll look at is the color of their skin, because it tells you a lot about someone's health status. When our children were brand newly born, they were tiny little preemies, and they spent 2 months in the NICU, and the senior nurse came by on the first day and said, you know, I know a lot of new parents just are itching to put some clothes on their babies, but we can't do that because we need to see the color of their skin in order to know how healthy these children are. And, you know, if they take a nosedive health-wise, we'll see it right away in the skin, which we won't see necessarily or hear in the monitors. And so, you know, you can build up a kind of cultural story that in America, historically, traditionally, you know, women have been more assigned to a kind of caregiving role. And so maybe they're sort of through cultural acclimatization and so on, more likely to care about color in that way. But certainly, you know, men are perfectly capable of having the same level of color as women. There is one way in which it's biologically determined that men can have sort of worse color vision. And that's that, you know, red-green color blindness is genetic and is carried on the X chromosome. And since men only have one X chromosome, if they've got a screw up on that X chromosome, it shows up as red-green colorblindness. So red-green colorblindness is much more common in men than it is in women. But the sort of disagreements that, you know, husbands and wives are having at the paint shop, those are very unlikely to have to do with, you know, genetic colorblindness.
Let's go to Carol now in De Pere. Carol, hi.
Hi. I have a question about light perception. I've only had light perception for several years now. Lost all detail and color vision, but I see yellow. Like today, the sun is out, I guess. So I see everywhere yellow. And if it's a cloudier day, it might be a grayish yellow. Is that just the visual cortex of the brain rather than anything with the retina?
What's the nature of your sort of health history? Have you lost most of your vision? Is this acquired? This is a new thing?
It's not new. I was low vision my whole life. I was preemie with an oxygen problem. But I had vision enough to get through college and work. But now, it's down to just light perception. And, you know, I do everything by audio now.
Interesting. Uh-huh. Carol, thanks for sharing that experience. Bevel, is this something you've encountered before?
So it could be a number of different things. And obviously, I'm not examining a patient right now. So I would caution against taking too seriously whatever I say. But, you know, as we age, one of the things that happens to your lens, that's the, you know, the focusing part of the focusing apparatus inside your eye, is that it yellows. And it could be possible, most people adapt to the yellowing of their lens with age, but it could be possible that is something that's contributing to her experience.
Thanks a lot for sharing that experience, Carol, at 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I've always wanted to say this. There's something dysfunctional when I see someone adding blue food coloring to a mini golf course waterfall or a casino pool or something. They don't need to add blue, but they want to add blue because they want people to perceive it as, you know, like a pristine blue pool of water. Mm-hmm. Water is clear.
Jeff, I worked at my uncle's swimming pool store back in the day. Yeah, there is a bluer, I can't remember what they call it, but a bluening product that you can add to water. We really want to perceive water as blue, Bevel, even though it's transparent, I guess.
I love the observation. I know in Chicago, I was there one year where they had their St. Patrick's Day parade, and they filled the river there with green, or the canal with green paint. And it was the most disconcerting visual experience. I mean, the blueness of water is interesting. The reason people like or think of water as being blue is obviously it's usually reflecting a blue sky, because the water functions as a very strong reflector. And so we have a kind of deeply ingrained association of blue and water. And I think that's probably where that impulse comes to try and fill it with blue coloring. But trying to match the color of the water to the color of the sky is a challenge, because, of course, the sky is constantly changing its color as the clouds go by. So I think what people don't anticipate is that when you look at the water, what you're really doing is stitching together the color that you're seeing in the water with the color of the sky in that instant. And that's what you're sort of after, is that kind of cohesion of a visual experience.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Okay, Bevel, here's something I had to bring up, because whenever I mention to people the topic of this conversation today, they talked about a time in their life, sometimes as a little kid or maybe as a college student or whatever, where they wondered, do I see the color, say, red the same way other people do? And like, it's a mind-wrecking philosophical quandary for them that I'm guessing you get asked about all the time, probably. What do you say to people when they bring that up?
Yeah, it's one of the oldest questions. It was raised first by John Locke, who is a philosopher, British empiricist philosopher, who asked, you know, when I look at a marigold flower, is it the same as you looking at a violet, you know, one of those violet colors? And the answer is, we can't really know for sure, but we do have some pretty darn good clues. The first is, you know, if really you experience color very differently from me, then we wouldn't have a conceptual framework that would allow us to have a meaningful conversation. And in the old days, it used to be thought that it's conceivable you could see a different color because maybe the tuning properties in your retina might be different. But what, now we know what the tuning properties are, and we know that they're consistent from person to person. So there's a pretty darn good chance that when you see red, I'm seeing the same thing. We do have some brain imaging data where we compare from one person to the next and show that there's a similar pattern of response in the two people. But, you know, the question is a hard one. And the reason it's a hard one is that we were astounded to discover that there is more brain, cerebral cortex, you know, the thinking part of your brain, involved in color perception. There's as much involved in color perception as there is involved in face recognition. So you have a lot of brain doing color, and it tells us that color is something really deep and fundamental to the human experience. So I'd find it hard to imagine that, you know, evolution would go to all the trouble to make all of that brain and have it spit out some random piece of noise that didn't mean anything to you and me.
It's a good place to leave it. Bevel, thanks a lot for sharing your research with us.
My pleasure. This has been fun.
That's Bevel Conway, a neuroscientist, artist, and senior investigator in the Perception, Cognition, and Action section of the National Eye Institute within the National Institutes of Health. He joined us today to talk about how we see colors and what colors tell us about the world around us. If you're wondering what art created by a neuroscientist who studies color looks like, you can follow his work at bevelconway.com. Let's get a link to that up on the program note. You can find that at wpr.org/centraltime. Cool 3D stuff. If you have a funny story to share about a disagreement over color, you can still share that. Email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, kids are heading back to school and cafeterias are getting ready for school lunch. Look behind the scenes at school lunch programs, how they work, and the policies and the politics behind them. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about why country music has been at the center of politics recently, including on the Republican primary debate stage. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, the first debate of the Republican primary opened with a song and a question about the song by country performer Oliver Anthony. The song became a viral success seemingly out of nowhere.
His lyrics speak of alienation, of deep frustration with the state of government and of this country. Washington, D.C. is about 100 miles north of Richmond.
Richmond, north of Richmond, Lord knows it all. Just wanna have total control. Wanna know what you think. Wanna know what you do. And they don't think you know, but I know that you do.
The popularity of Richmond, north of Richmond, comes not long after the controversial music video for Jason Aldean's Try That in a Small Town went viral and achieved success, especially on the political right.
Try that in a small town, see how far you make it down the road. Around here we take care of our own. You cross that line, it won't take long for you to find out. I recommend you don't try that in a small town.
We're taking a look at why country music has been at the center of politics lately and what it can tell us about the genre and our political climate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a country music fan? What do you think of Oliver Anthony's viral hit? How about try that in a small town? What kind of values do you see expressed in the country music that you listen to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Our next guests are co-founders of the music newsletter No Fences Review. Charles Hughes is a music writer and historian and director of the Lynn and Henry Turley Memphis Center at Rhodes College. He was born and raised in Wausau and is a UW-Madison alum. Charles, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, it's always great to be on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you for having me.
And David Cantwell is a music writer, author of the book The Running Kind, Listening to Merle Haggard. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on. I'm from the lower Midwest, down in Kansas City, but it's great to be up here with you guys.
You're from the neighborhood, David. We'll accept that for sure. Now, David, at the beginning of August, we saw the top three spots of the Billboard Hot 100, three country songs. I think for the first time in history, we had Fast Car by Luke Combs. We had that Try That in a Small Town, and then Morgan Wallen was up there as well. Before we dig into the politics, what do you make of that trifecta for country music?
Well, I'd like to celebrate it, but I don't think you can separate it from the politics. It's all three of those songs in their different ways, especially the Aldean, Try That in a Small Town, and the Morgan Wallen song, I think are totally, not totally, I take that back, but largely driven by people who are not necessarily country fans trying to boost a particular political agenda, seeing an opportunity to do that, and sending them to the top of the charts through streaming.
Charles, we have these political back and forths over the Oliver Anthony song in particular and the Aldean song and video. This isn't the first time, you know, country music has taken political stands and become political controversy. Does this seem different this time around to you?
In one way, no, because country music, like a lot of cultural forms in the United States, especially those that have been predominantly identified with white people, have always had a tense, if not problematic, tendency to, you know, to demonstrate some of the more problematic and even vicious dynamics in American politics. And certainly, even in its less malicious ways, you can hear things in those songs that are tapping into the anxieties and the anger and a lot of things that you've heard in country music for a long time. You hear a lot of other things in country music too, which maybe we can talk about. But in another way, it absolutely feels different in the sense that something seems to be kind of happening right now, whether it's just coincidentally or whether it's more coordinated, in which after a couple of years in which country music seemed on the mainstream level to be perhaps kind of opening up a little bit, thanks to the insistence of artists and fans of color and also queer and trans artists and communities. It seems like in response to that now, we're having this kind of resurgence of the angry white men, not only who are kind of staking their claim again to be at the center of the country conversation, but also are really exhibiting a lot of the kind of markers and shorthand and dog whistles that we hear in this particular moment on the right. And another part of that has to do with what David just said, which is this is being fueled not just by streaming and by the digital world, but by a particular set of right-wing media figures. And I think that that's really crucial. That's something that maybe could have happened in earlier generations if such technology existed. But certainly it's happening now, and it's making this moment, I think, a much more amplified situation.
Now, Oliver Anthony, we heard a bit of his song, Rich Man North of Richmond, embraced by conservatives, Republicans playing it to kick off, or Fox playing it to kick off that Republican presidential debate. Now, Oliver Anthony said, well, hang on, guys, here he is in a response video. Try to create some distance, I think, from conservatives promoting his song.
It was funny seeing it at the presidential debate, because it's like, I wrote that song about those people. You know, so for them to have to sit there and listen to that, that cracks me up. but it was funny kind of seeing the response to it. Like, that song has nothing to do with Joe Biden, you know? It's a lot bigger than Joe Biden.
David, you wrote a piece for Time Magazine looking at the rise of rich men north of Richmond. Could you talk a little bit about how it was embraced and then what we just heard from Oliver Anthony there?
Well, I think that what we just heard from Anthony is a good example of, you know, what's happened. He's trying to distance himself from Republicans. But then as soon as that exact interview was retweeted by Ted Cruz and favorably saying, it's just like Ronald Reagan said, government is not the solution to your problem. Government is not the solution to your problem. Government is the problem. And it's also emblematic of this entire, I think, Trump era moment when people are constantly sort of trying to say neither Republican nor Democrat. It's what we want to do is tear the whole thing down. And so I think that that's a big part of it. That one of the things I would say about his song that I tried to emphasize in the piece was that one valuable thing about it, potentially about Anthony's song, is that he tries to foreground class. He sings about lousy wages for soul robbing work, jobs you hate, but just need the same. Need just the same is like something that country used to do all the time. It specialized in it. But this century, country, and this is especially true of the mainstream subset of country music, has tended to focus on the signifiers of blue collar culture and instead left the economic troubles behind. So people sing about nowadays living in a small town and driving a truck and drinking beer or tequila, but there's rarely any sense that anyone has to actually get up and go to work in the morning. And so that Anthony is recognizing that is, I would like to see more of that on country radio. But then he immediately pivots to punching down in this punitive way against people who are on welfare, people who he thinks are overweight, people who he thinks don't make good choices with their dollars. And that's a classic trap. That goes back to the Reagan era welfare queen with all its ugly racial implications, and about trying to pit one group of struggling folks against another group of struggling folks and making sure that the rich men are the ones who just get richer while the poor people get poverty.
Talking to music writers David Catwall and Charles Hughes, creators of the music newsletter No Fences Review, looking at some political controversies on a couple country music songs, country music hits. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rob is with us in Madison. Rob, hi.
Hey, guys, thanks for the topic. I really appreciate this because, you know, I've listened to the Jason Aldean tune. I know that Jason was on stage in Las Vegas when that mass shooting occurred, and I know that he was impacted greatly by that. And I'm not sure, just exactly without hearing it from Jason Aldean, what his message really is in that song. I do advocacy work in the community, people of color. I'm in Wisconsin. I've gone into small towns where black men have inexplicitly been killed and no one was ever charged. And I have kind of listened to that song, and for me, it's got a double meaning. I look at it and go, try that in a small town is kind of like, that's the most likely place for a police cover up. So any idea if any of you have any input into what Jason may have thought about in that song? Maybe he didn't even write it.
Rob, thanks for the call. And Charles, I think Rob is correct. That was written for Jason Aldean, not by Jason Aldean. Yeah. But your thoughts on Rob's thoughts about small towns of Jason Aldean.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that call. Thank you. Thank you, Rob. I mean, Aldean didn't write the song, which doesn't really matter because in a sense, you know, Nashville country, like a lot of popular genres, has always been about a relationship between individual songwriters and performers, right? The only reason it does matter is when Aldean kind of starts talking about how this is this true expression of his belief, you know, like it does beg the question of, okay, the song was written and then you recorded it, right? But I think absolutely that there is a signaling going on with Try That in a Small Town that speaks to what Rob was talking about. Now, of course, one of the things that it also, you know, there's a lot of folks from small towns, and, you know, Wausau's not a tiny town, but it's not a huge place either, right? Like, and like, you know, small towns are also not necessarily the only place, certainly, where this kind of violence happens. But there is something really, I think, very telling and dangerous about the rhetoric that Aldean employs in this song, because it taps into a much longer historical usage of this separation, the supposed separation between this peaceful small town and the crime-filled big city. And it goes back earlier than country music and more and wider than country music. I mean, in a sense, this is straight out of how in the 19th century, blackface minstrelsy, which was, you know, an incredibly popular form of theatrical entertainment, including especially in the urban north, right, kind of harkened back to this supposed bucolic, sweet, sunny south of the old days, right? And that was accompanied by this implicit and sometimes explicit threat that if anybody came in there and caused trouble, which included things like, you know, trying to push back against injustices or trying to do things like that, that they would face violence. So to me, what Al Dean's message is pretty simple. It's pretty clear. And I think beyond the connection to the history, the other thing that, you know, even before I saw the video, which was just odious in the way that it employed, you know, perfectly legal, constitutionally protected activity as being things that supposedly had to be taken care of in the small town. Even before I heard that, you know, I heard lyrics about how, oh, if you, you know, come to a small town and try to, you know, defy the police, or come to a small town and try to do the drug dealing. And like, those are signals that I remember hearing growing up in Wisconsin that were very clear racial shorthand. And also now, you know, when you're talking about the police, it that is purely existing in a post Black Lives Matter moment. So I'm not sure what his message is, but I think he's been pretty clear, and I think the song is pretty clear, that it is absolutely the kind of threat, or the kind of promise, maybe, that Rob is accurately recognizing there.
Rob, thanks for the call. We're talking to music writers Charles Hughes and David Cantwell, co-founders of the music newsletter No Fences Review, looking at trends in country music, how they reflect and interact with our current political landscape. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want your favorite country musicians to take political stands one way or the other? Have you followed some of the songs we're talking about? Maybe talked about them with members of your family, your friends, or coworkers? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with music writers Charles Hughes and David Cantwell, co-founders of the music newsletter No Fences Review. We're talking to them about how American politics are reflected and influenced by, maybe, country music. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, David, you mentioned earlier there are other themes out there in country music, other voices. I want to give a listen to one here. Tyler Childers, who wrote this song in the wake of the 2020 George Floyd protests.
It's called me belligerent. It's took me for ignorant, but it ain't never once made me scared. Constantly worrying, kicking, fighting, begging to breathe.
David, country music isn't just conservative voices. Can you talk about the varieties of perspectives out there?
There's quite a bit. That Tyler Childers song is fantastic, and he's one of the few, you know, who's really come out and tried to sort of say, okay, these are my people. A lot of them are conservative. I'm going to try to, you know, just talk to them in a song about the very things that they're concerned about. And so my hat's off to him. He also, as your listeners may know, recently released just a straight up love song. But then when he chose to make a video of it, he made it two working class men, two miners who fell in love with one another. And that is an actually in this moment when there's a lot of, I don't know, to use the buzzword, toxic masculinity, which I hear definitely in the Jason Aldean, and I hear definitely in Oliver Anthony and so many others, you know, to hear him sort of push back against that, I'm really impressed by Childers there. I wish more country artists who are associated, at least in the popular imagination, with the left or the liberal side of the American political discourse would speak up. Dolly Parton, Willie Nelson, people like that, mostly they've kept their mouths shut. A lot of artists, though, are doing a great job talking back to that. I think one of the things I know Charles and I wanted to do today was to sort of just, like, you know, as much as we can, just like list all of the artists that are off, all of the country and country adjacent artists that are making progressive and excellent music. I'll start that list if Charles wants to join in, but like Luke Combs, his Fast Car hit is a version of the Tracy Chapman mm-hmm. Fast Car song. One of her great descendants is Joy Ladekins, and her album this year, Proof of Life, might be my favorite album of the year. It's not going to get on country radio stations, but it's that's not because of how it sounds. Mm-hmm. Britney Spencer, Tanner Adele, your readers, listeners may know Brandy's Clark and Carlisle, Yola, Amethyst Kia, Dia Victoria. I could go on and on. Charles could too. This is one of the things that all of this controversy around these right wing talking points that get brought up in country obscures is that this is one of the great moments in country music history, and so much of it is out there, and no one is really talking about it as much as they could be. My own personal dream of a country radio format would be one that is, you know, egalitarian, that is multiracial, democratic, right? And it's there. If you get off the radio and begin to listen to all these other, some of those artists I just mentioned, and so many more, it's right there. It's happening. It's taking shape. And whether it turns into a genre of its own or it gets melded into the country music as it's popularly known, this is all, I'm not optimistic about any of that happening, but for music fans, you know, it's happening right now. This is such a fiercely an exciting moment in country music.
Charles, before we go back to our callers, do you want to add a couple names to David's list?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and David is 100% right. And yeah, I mean, this is such a great time for country music, and this is such a great time to learn about country music that you, through ways other than the radio, or through ways other than the kind of standard channels. You know, a couple names who immediately popped to mind. I absolutely amen all of the artists that David named. I want to shout out Adeem the Artist, who is an incredible singer-songwriter, whose most recent album is just really powerfully affecting. You know, I do want to acknowledge people like Maren Morris, who is one of the few kind of mainstream successful country artists who is really fully in that mainstream space, who has been really, really assertive and active, and sometimes at the, you know, to the detriment of her image in terms of country music. You know, Jason Aldean has previously said some very nasty things about Maren Morris because she had the audacity to suggest that trans rights were human rights. But she's fantastic, and her colleagues in the High Women are great. Boy, I could, there's a great new album that just came out by a group called One, the Duo, O-N-E, the Duo, that is this amazing country pop record that is not only a really incredible duo of Black women, but is one of them is the RZA's daughter from the Wu-Tang Clan, and the other is a Wu-Tang former backup singer, and they just made an incredible country record that ought to get played everywhere, and it won't. But there's so much good stuff, you know, and so many amazing artists who are not only pushing back, but pushing out, pushing insisting on that big tent, you know, what the great bluegrass artist Molly Tuttle calls the big backyard. And it's a wonderful time to be a fan, even as it's also discouraging in some ways.
I want to bring on one more caller. Joe is with us in Watersmeet, Michigan. Joe, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Joe?
I wanted to say that I believe you guys have the meaning of Aldean's song completely wrong. And I believe what it is about, from friends that I've talked to. I have Black friends. There's an Indian tribe that lives in my town, and I am from a small town. I've been in a small town for almost 50-some years. And I come from a town population of about 800, and everyone that I've talked to have said, you know, Aldean is correct in the meaning of his song as far as we will stand up for anyone and everyone. It does not matter what their race, income, if they're Black, Asian, Indian, it does not matter.
Joe, thanks for the call. We just have a few moments left. Charles, Joe has a different read on the meaning.
Very quickly, that's not what the song says at all. And I mean, I certainly think people can hear things in it, but that's not what the song says. The song says that if you come into a small town and cause trouble, we will deal with you. And I mean, I certainly don't want to take away from Joe's experience or his Black friends. That he has. But the reality is, when you hear that song, I think there's a very clear reason why, when a lot of people heard that song and saw that video, what we immediately thought of is the violence that he says over and over and over again. So while I think there's plenty of space and wonderful songs about that small town community, I don't know that Jason Aldean is suggesting that in the song or the video. And I kind of wish that what Joe is talking about was what Jason Aldean is talking about. But
and we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guests, Charles Hughes and David Cantwell. You can follow their work at No Fences Review. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.